Everybody knows what love is. Some people love wealth. Others love beautiful forms or fame. If people who love wealth are separated from it, that is known as the suffering of being apart from what one loves. How might this happen? Suppose someone is very wealthy. He has a flourishing business, but suddenly, due to unforeseeable circumstances, he goes bankrupt. He loses everything. That's a case of being apart from what one loves. In his case, he loved money. He didn't ever want to be separated from money, and then suddenly, he's penniless. Next, let's consider someone who loves beautiful forms. Men love the looks of women. Women love the looks of men. Between them, there's a mutual love. But if in their former lives the causes and effects were not planted correctly, then the love will not last. Something will happen and they'll have to part with each other. That's the kind of suffering that occurs between men and women when they must be apart from those they love. Then, there are those who love fame. Some people say that fame is one's second life. But sometimes your reputation gets ruined. You lose your fame. Basically, if you wanted to be well known but then did something wrong and ruined your own reputation, that's a case of being apart from what you love. Fame. But then you say, well, there might be a couple who doesn't separate and so they don't have to undergo the suffering of being apart from those they love. But they might have a child who is both handsome and intelligent, and all of a sudden, unexpectedly, he dies. That's extremely hard to bear. Or suppose you are a person who is especially filial towards your parents, and then your parents die. That's another example of being apart from those you love. Or maybe you have an excellent relationship with your spouse and then suddenly he or she dies unexpectedly. That's also an example of being apart from those you love. The same thing applies to brothers, sisters, friends. In each case, the suffering of being apart from those you love can arise. Once you have experienced this kind of suffering, you should no longer be attached to love. You shouldn't direct all your love towards one person. Instead, develop a kind regard for all living beings. Practice the Bodhisattva path and save everybody. Don't only think of yourself, think of all living beings instead. Rescue and protect everybody. Then you will not experience the suffering of being apart from those you love. Some people are masochists. They like to suffer. If there's no suffering, they look for it. For instance, a man gets married and then he starts worrying from morning to night that his wife will find a lover. Basically, there wasn't any suffering to begin with, but he created it. And if a woman marries a particularly handsome man, she may have the same concern, or create it. She never thinks about anything else but how her handsome husband is going to get a girlfriend. Wouldn't you say that's stupid? Some people direct their love not at other people, but at their pets. In fact, there are people who love their cats or dogs more than life itself. When the dog dies or the cat gets lost, they feel as if they had lost their very life. That's another example of being apart from those one loves. The sixth kind of suffering is that of being together with those one hates. Of course, some people overreact and think, well, since love entails so much suffering, I'm not going to love anybody. I'll hate everybody. So you detest everyone and you don't love anything, including material objects. You feel that since love is so much suffering, you don't want to love. But not loving also has its suffering. That's the suffering of being together with those you hate. Maybe you find yourself in a circumstance in which you don't like where you are, or you don't like the people who are around you, and so you move. But then, who would have guessed that when you get to the new place, the people are all the same sort as in the place you just left, and things are just as despicable. In fact, it's even worse. In general, the things that you most wish to avoid and the things you detest the most are the very things that come around. It's strange how this happens. For instance, if you're afraid of cats, then from morning to night, there are cats hanging around. Suppose you hate dogs with a passion, and everywhere you go, you have dogs trailing you. Or you hate women, but all day there are women wanting to see you. They chase after you and you get totally fed up, so you move. But at your new place, there's another group of women just like them. Well, how does this suffering arise? It comes from your own nature. Because your intrinsic nature doesn't have any samadhi, you find fault with whatever you see. Say you're in one place where you can't get along with any of your neighbors, so you move someplace else, and you still can't get along with any of your new neighbors. Then, that's not a question of the neighbors, it's probably a question of your lack of ability to get along. You just don't have any affinities with anyone, so nobody likes you. You can see that the more you're attached to something, the more likely you'll be separated from it. By the same token, the more you hate and wish to avoid something, the more you're going to get involved with it. These two, the suffering of love and the suffering of hate, come about because you don't truly understand the middle way. As soon as you go to an extreme, either of too much or of too little, you're going to suffer. If you could hold to the middle way, you wouldn't suffer. The seventh kind of suffering is that of not getting whatever one seeks. Some people work hard, hoping to make a fortune, but they remain poor to the end of their lives. Some people spend their whole lives seeking for an official position, but in the end, they never make it. Some people try to become famous, but they can't make it either. Some people don't have any children, and no matter how much they try, they are never able to have a child. That's another example of not getting what one seeks. In general, people spend their whole lives trying to get this or trying to get that, but in the end, they don't get what they want. Some people would like to get a PhD, but it's not their destiny to be students, because from of old, they haven't planted those kinds of causes. For example, there was Yao Liang Hao, who became top scholar in China when he was 82. But not long after he got the honor, he died. If you get something and then can't enjoy it, that's just another version of the suffering connected with not getting what you seek. Then, there's the suffering of the raging blaze of the five skandhas. Form, feeling, thought, formation, and consciousness. In the Heart Sutra, it says, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. The point is, if you can see things as empty, you won't have any suffering. But if you can't see things as empty, then you'll be burned by the five skandhas. Those are a raging blaze. But although they are so much suffering, no one can bear to separate from them. The first seven kinds of suffering are caused by external forms of defilement. This eighth suffering is innate. It's inherent in the five skandhas from birth. It never leaves you, and even if you want to part with it, you can't get free. This has been a discussion on the eight kinds of sufferings. Sutra. True contemplator, pure contemplator, contemplator with vast great wisdom, compassionate contemplator, kind contemplator, may we constantly behold you with reverence. Commentary. True contemplator, pure contemplator. True contemplation is the contemplation of true emptiness. True emptiness is no self, no others, no living beings, and no lifespan. There's no appearance of self, no appearance of others, no appearance of living beings, and no appearance of a lifespan. However, no appearance is not apart from appearance. This just means that right within the appearance itself, there's no appearance. Within the appearance of self, there's no appearance of self. Within the appearance of others, there's no appearance of others. Within the appearance of living beings, there's no appearance of living beings. Within the appearance of a lifespan, there's no appearance of a lifespan. There is a saying that goes, the eyes see form, but inside there is nothing. The ears hear defiling sounds, but the mind does not know. It's perfectly clear that shape and form exist, and your eyes see them. So why do we say that inside there's nothing? It's because there is no attachment. The contemplation of true emptiness can be likened to a great perfect mirror. When things appear before a great and perfect mirror, they are reflected in it. When they leave, no trace is left. This is the contemplation of true emptiness practiced by Guanyin Bodhisattva. Pure contemplation is the contemplation of purity. Purity is the opposite of defilement. What is defilement? Anything you're attached to is a defiled thing. Anything that you have fond regard for is a defiled thing. Anything that you are greedy for is a defiled thing. Within the contemplation of purity, there is no greed, hatred, or stupidity. Take giving, for example. When most people give, they first have to think about it. This person is related to me as a friend, a relative, or neighbor, so I'll help him out by giving him something. You first figure it all out and decide to give only to the people who are closest to you, and you pay no regard to those with whom you are unfamiliar. This is called taking care of one's relatives first, without having concern for any others. Paying attention to those who are close and ignore those who are distant. In other words, you make distinctions. You are attached to appearances, and so your regard is not pure. But Guanyin Bodhisattva doesn't make distinctions between himself and others. He doesn't distinguish between relatives and those who aren't related to him, or between those who are close and those who are distant. He simply gives. There are three kinds of giving: the giving of wealth, the giving of dharma, and the giving of fearlessness. Of wealth, there are two kinds: inner wealth and outer wealth. It would probably be difficult for most people to figure out what it meant by inner wealth, but most people would be able to figure out what is meant by outer wealth. Inner wealth refers to those things inside your body, and outer wealth refers to things outside your body. The giving of outer wealth refers to giving up of one's country, city, wife, or children. This whole town belongs to me. I own it all, but I'll give it away. In some cases, one is able to give away all one's property and assets, or even one's own wife and children. That's really putting everything down. That's true giving. The giving of inner wealth means to give up one's body, nature, mind, and life to save living beings who are in need. The body refers to the entire physical body: head, eyes, brain, marrow, and so forth. When Venerable Shariputra was trying to practice the Bodhisattva path, someone came along and said that he really needed an eye to cure his ill mother. Shariputra then gouged out one of his eyes and gave it to that person. Who would have guessed that that person would say it was the wrong eye and then throw it on the ground? At that point, Shariputra retreated from the Bodhisattva path. It's too hard. I can't do it. And so Shariputra was only able to relinquish half of his inner wealth. He couldn't quite part with the other half. In general, the giving of inner wealth means giving up one's internal treasures, one's own wisdom and energy. The giving of dharma means speaking dharma in order to teach and transform living beings. Of the three kinds of giving, this is the greatest. And so it's said, of all the kinds of giving, the greatest is the giving of dharma. Now, the Buddhist lecture hall here is not large, that's true. But then the power of the dharma is not small either. On Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, we have three different lecturers speaking the Dharma. There probably isn't any other Buddhist organization in America as busy as the Buddhist Lecture Hall, where people forget their very lives for the sake of the Dharma. During the day, everyone has to work. Even I get involved in whatever work there is to be done, working to the point that my bones ache. But in the evening, no matter who is lecturing, you should all come and listen. First of all, this is supporting the way place. If a lot of people come to the lecture, then the atmosphere is good. So if you want to support the Buddhist lecture hall, you don't need to make a big donation. Just come to the lectures. There are those who propagate the teachings by giving lectures on the Buddha Dharma, those who do publicity for the lectures, and those who support the lectures and the way place. By supporting the way place and causing it to flourish, you are also supporting Buddhism and the Triple Jewel. This is everyone's responsibility. Up to now, most Westerners have had a pretty childish understanding of the Buddha Dharma. They don't really understand it at all. For example, there are those in America who call themselves elders, Dharma masters, and priests. But if you ask them what Buddhism is all about, they don't know. You have studied the Sharangama Sutra for 3 months, and you understand quite a bit of Buddhism now. As to the giving of Dharma, you should take whatever Buddha Dharma you understand and spread it among all people, to the point that you wouldn't even mind going without food or sleep in order to speak Dharma. It was that way with me in the past. If someone wanted to study the Dharma, I would explain it to them, even if that meant missing my lunch and sleep, until I could help them achieve a thorough understanding. I hope that all of you will be my transformation bodies and spread the Buddha Dharma in this way. Practice the giving of Dharma. There is much more value in spreading Dharma than in contributing any amount of money. So you should vigorously apply yourselves in studying the Dharma. Now there are several of you who want to leave the home life. This is very rare. You could say that we have begun something brand new in America, because for people to want to leave home to become bhikshus and bhikshunis is very unusual. We must establish a foundation, and each one of us should personally take responsibility for the future of Buddhism in the West. Don't just hang back and say, "Well, it has nothing to do with me. Buddhism is not my business. It's someone else's." As far as I'm concerned, as long as I have a single breath left, spreading the Buddha Dharma is my personal responsibility. And if someone else wants to take responsibility for it too, how wonderful! Don't shirk your responsibility. Stand on your own and take the task of propagating the Buddha Dharma as your own. That's the first criterion for the process of giving Dharma. The giving of fearlessness is the last one of the three kinds of giving. For instance, Guanyin Bodhisattva saves living beings from the seven difficulties, dispels the three poisons, and responds to the two kinds of seeking. That's an example of the giving of fearlessness. When people are in a terrifying situation and their very lives are at stake, if you appear in a fearless body to rescue them, then you are practicing the giving of fearlessness. What does appearing in a fearless body mean? Well, suppose someone gets caught in a fire and is about to be burned to death. He's lost his sense of direction and can't find his way out. And at that time, without any regard for your own physical well-being, you rush right into the blaze and pull him out. That's an extremely difficult thing to be able to do. That's an example of renouncing your own life in order to save the life of another. And that's an example of the giving of fearlessness. Or, perhaps someone falls into the sea and is just about to drown. And when you see this happening, you are able to make a split-second decision without any regard for your own physical safety and immediately jump into the sea in order to save that person's life. That's also the giving of fearlessness. And you can extend this attitude to where you might find yourself in the midst of fighting armies and someone gets wounded in the front line, perhaps by gunfire, or by being hit by a shell, and he's right at the battlefront with his life hanging in the balance. If you can, with total disregard for your own safety, without even thinking about whether or not you'll live through it, go into the most dangerous spot imaginable in order to save that person's life, that's also called the giving of fearlessness. Or perhaps someone is persecuted by the government, or is involved in some kind of difficulty or circumstance where he is just about to be killed. If you can use any number of good and clever expedient means in order to save that person without any regard for the dangers involved, that's called the practice of giving fearlessness. In general, this means that whenever a person finds himself in a dangerous situation and you use courage, compassion, and heroic vigor to go in absolutely unafraid in order to save him, that's the giving of fearlessness. You can also practice the giving of fearlessness in an indirect way, like the Bodhisattva guardian of the earth. This Bodhisattva knew that people in a certain place needed a bridge in order to get across a river. If they tried to cross the river without a bridge, their lives would be in danger, and it would be a frightening experience for them. Since this happened in ancient times, he had to use a primitive technique. For instance, he could build a pontoon bridge of logs floating on the river with flat boards on top of them, so that people could cross the river without incurring any danger upon themselves. Of course, if there was a flood, their lives would still be endangered. However, they no longer suffered the fear of crossing that river. When the venerable elder master Xu Yin came down from Jiuhua Mountain, remembering that there was a bridge at a particular spot on the river, he went to that place to cross the river. But the river was swollen, and the bridge had been destroyed by a flood. Since the bridge was no longer there, he accidentally fell into the river. He floated in the river for a day and a night, bobbing up and down for a total of 24 hours. Eventually, an old fisherman caught him in his net. Thinking that he had caught a giant fish, the old man started to pull the fish out. But on closer examination, he discovered that his fish was in fact a person wearing a monk's robes. Nearby there was a little temple, and so the fisherman went to alert the left home people there. The monk recognized the venerable master immediately. They then set about applying artificial respiration and bringing him back to consciousness. At that point, the master truly gained a second life. Having escaped death after nearly drowning in the river, the venerable master proceeded to Gaomin Monastery. He went there to participate in a chant session, but he was still very ill and weak from his recent ordeal. However, he didn't breathe a single word about his mishap, and so nobody knew. The abbot then asked him to represent him as the head of the session. But the master Xu Yin, knowing himself that he was too sick, refused. Now, refusing to accept an appointment by the abbot was considered a breach of monastic discipline, and for this, the master was beaten with the incense board. Still, he never said a word. The venerable master was the foremost monk, the loftiest, good and wise advisor in all of China, but he underwent tremendous suffering at Gaomin Monastery, where everyone looked down on him. "He's just a burden to us," they said, "totally useless." Now, back to the Bodhisattva guardian of the earth. He fixed the roads and bridges. When Elder Master Xu Yin went to Yunnan Province, he met a monk who spent all his time fixing the roads, and this monk didn't speak. That indeed was a transformation body of guardian of the earth bodhisattva. This bodhisattva spent all of his time guarding the earth. If there were rocks or rubble on the roads, he would remove them to one side so that people wouldn't step on them and hurt their feet. He kept the roads in good repair. Who paid him for all his hard labor? Nobody. Now, wasn't he stupid? Wasn't he just working in vain? Well, his working in vain enabled him to become the bodhisattva guardian of the earth. He cultivated to the point that he was irreversible in position, irreversible in thought, and irreversible in practice. He obtained these three kinds of irreversibility, the state of non-retreat. If we were to discuss the giving of fearlessness, we could go on, because the topic is very vast. In general, any time another person is afraid, you should practice this kind of giving. Suppose a person hasn't eaten in a few days and is on the brink of starving to death, so that he feels he may have to steal, even though he knows that's against the law. And then, when this person is really down and out, you see him. You see that he's sallow and so thin that he can hardly walk, and you ask him, "What's wrong with you? Are you sick?" And the person answers, "I haven't eaten for days." And you say, "Well, why don't you come home with me and have a meal?" Don't be like the people of Tianjin who ask you if you've eaten. A common way of greeting someone in China. And when you say you haven't, they say, "Well, let's go home and eat." It isn't clear whether they are asking you to go to their home or to your own home. So, even if you were positively starving, you wouldn't dare assume that they were inviting you to their home, so you say, "Okay, I'll go to my own home and eat." If you provide food to the starving, clothing to those who are cold, and shelter for those who are homeless, you are practicing the giving of fearlessness. On the other hand, people shouldn't rely on others to provide for them day after day. There is a saying, "You can give a person a meal, but you can't feed him forever." Every able-bodied person should work to support himself. You shouldn't think, "When it's time for lunch, I'll just go find someone who cultivates the bodhisattva path and ask him to practice giving." If you're really going through hard times and have nothing to eat, then it's okay. But you shouldn't make it a regular practice. As long as you have the strength, you should stand on your own two feet and make a contribution to the world. Don't just live off the world's resources. Helping the world means benefiting others, not hoping that others will benefit you. Be self-reliant. Don't depend on other people. Contemplator with vast, great wisdom. Guanyin Bodhisattva uses the regard of great wisdom to cross over all living beings. Compassionate contemplator, kind contemplator. The Bodhisattva also has universal compassionate regard for all living beings. The contemplation of compassion pulls living beings out of suffering. The contemplation of kindness gives living beings joy. This kind of joy is not temporary happiness, but an everlasting bliss that transcends the mundane. The Bodhisattva gives Dharma to living beings, causing them to gain true understanding of the Buddha Dharma and thereby not do any more upside-down things. This is called the giving of happiness. What is meant by upside-down things? Let me tell you truly and honestly, even though there are those who won't believe me. One such thing is getting drunk. People who are drunk think that they've turned into gods. They stagger around bumping into things left and right and think it's great. It gets to the point that they are totally oblivious and can't tell which direction is which. Wouldn't you say that's upside down? Under the influence of intoxicants, even a perfectly intelligent person can commit murder, arson, and all sorts of crimes. When I was at the bus stop this morning, a drunkard came up to me and asked for money. When I smelled the reek of alcohol on his breath, I started walking away, but he followed me, determined to get some money. What for? To buy more alcohol. I guess he hadn't had enough yet. Isn't that upside down? This reminds me of another incident that also happened at a bus stop. That time, a total stranger walked up to me and without saying a word, knelt down and kowtowed to me. Then he got up and walked off. Now, he wasn't bowing to me because he wanted money. I don't know why he did it. He didn't know me, and I didn't know him. Yet, among all those people, he came and bowed to me. He didn't look drunk to me, so he must have been inspired somehow. Mostly it's ghosts and spirits who bow to me when they see me. But this person bowed to me very respectfully, and when he got up, he kept his head lowered and didn't dare look straight at my face. Perhaps there was a ghost on him who recognized me. If drinking alcohol is upside down, what about smoking? Smoking is even more so. Why? Your insides are clean to begin with. Dharma Master, you're wrong. My insides are full of excrement and urine. True, but that kind of uncleanliness is okay. If you smoke, you put smoke and tar in your body, and that's really unclean. Have you seen the black stuff that coats the inside of a used pipe? When you inhale the smoke, your lungs get coated with that stuff too. You don't realize it because you can't see it, but your lungs get coated with every puff you take. Just like a mirror getting covered with layer upon layer of dust. Basically, your insides are clean, but you want to cover them with filth. Isn't that upside down? When people smoke opium, they feel so energetic and strong that they think that they can ascend to the heavens right then and there. But after a while, they feel extremely uncomfortable all over, to the point that they want to crawl into the hells because they think the hells must be better than what they're going through. Wouldn't you say that's upside down? There are many other upside down things that people do. I hope people who smoke will quit smoking soon, and those who drink will quickly give up alcohol. Lazy people should learn to be a little more vigorous. Vigorous people, however, should not learn to be lazy. They should do more wholesome and virtuous deeds. If you never do wholesome deeds, you won't accrue any virtue. Where does virtue come from? From good deeds. If you do as many good deeds as you can, you'll naturally accumulate virtue and get rid of laziness. If you don't do good deeds, but you spend hard-earned money to go see plays or buy frivolous things, then that's called being upside down. If you spend your money on useful things, then you're not being upside down. Wasting money on useless things is upside down. So, upside downness takes many forms. Guanxu Yin Bodhisattva points out your upside down conduct and tells you not to be upside down, causing you to obtain genuine and everlasting happiness. This is kindness. Compassion pulls living beings out of suffering. A bodhisattva eradicates not only your present suffering, but your suffering in life after life throughout limitless eons. But you must have faith. If you have faith, Guanyin Bodhisattva will regard you with kindness and compassion. If you do not have faith, the Bodhisattva's kindness and compassion cannot melt your cold stance. What is your cold stance? Just your lack of faith. If you have faith, you will unite with the kind regard and compassionate regard of Guanyin Bodhisattva. And when that happens, you can leave suffering and attain happiness. What is real suffering? Affliction is. If you don't have any affliction, that's happiness. The reason you don't feel happy is because you have affliction. So, Guanyin Bodhisattva can pull you out of your affliction and help you attain genuine happiness. May we constantly behold you with reverence. You will continually gaze up at Guanyin Bodhisattva with respect. You wish to always look upon that virtuous and kind countenance. The more you look, the happier you become. For instance, bowing the Great Compassion Repentance is a ceremony to show your respect to Guanyin Bodhisattva. It's said that Americans don't like to bow. They say, "Well, I believe in my own Buddha." Well, if you truly believed in your own Buddha, then there wouldn't be any you. There wouldn't be any your own. It's just because you haven't found your own Buddha that you cannot recognize an external Buddha when you see one. If you really believed in your own Buddha, it wouldn't keep you from bowing. Bowing, that is, kowtowing, a full bow to the floor, represents the most respectful of gestures. In Buddhism, this is a kind of formal courtesy. If you can't even perform this kind of courtesy, how can you call yourself someone who believes in the Buddha? There's a certain doctor who commanded respect from many people, but he himself told everyone not to bow to the Buddha. When others bowed to the Buddha, he would stand there like a wooden stick. That's because he hadn't really broken through the mark of his ego. People refuse to bow to the Buddha because of arrogance. Me? Why should I bow to the Buddha? If you are self-satisfied and proud to the point that you can't even bow, then how in the world do you expect to be able to study Buddhism? Sutra. Undefiled pure light, the sun of wisdom that breaks through the darkness, is able to quell calamities of wind and fire as it shines on all worlds. Commentary. These four lines of text are ineffably wonderful. They can cure eye sicknesses. If you have problems with your eyes and you constantly recite this four-line verse, your eye disease will be cured. However, although your eye disease may be cured, You still have to go ahead and bring forth wisdom in order to be totally cured. If you don't have wisdom, then even though you may temporarily get better, your illness could crop up again in the future. In general, if you truly believe in the power of the sutra text, then Guanyin Bodhisattva's awesome spiritual strength will aid you and bring about an efficacious effect. But if you don't believe, nothing special will happen. There won't be any effect. That's why it said, the Buddha Dharma is like a great sea, but only through faith can you enter. The verse says, undefiled pure light. Defilement refers to dust, dirt, and unclean things. Being without any defilement means that you don't have any random thinking. For every random thought that you strike up, you add another layer of dust upon your original pure nature. The more polluted thinking you have, the dustier it gets. Therefore, you need to understand the mind and see the nature. That's what people who investigate Chan aim to do. To understand the mind is to be undefiled. To see your nature is to see the pure light mentioned here. Your original mind is your permanently dwelling true mind, the treasury of the Thus Come One. Understanding your mind and seeing your nature simply means understanding your inherent treasury of the Thus Come One. The Sun of Wisdom that breaks through the darkness. The Wisdom Sun means that wisdom is like the sun. The kind of darkness referred to here is a lack of faith, a lack of wisdom, a lack of vows, and a lack of resolve to truly practice. Darkness also refers to not studying or upholding the precepts, not cultivating the power of samadhi, and not developing the power of wisdom. If you don't study precepts, samadhi, and wisdom, you're walking a dark path. If you do cultivate according to precepts, samadhi, and wisdom, then you're walking on a bright path. We can also explain it in this way. Your desire to listen to the Buddha Dharma is the light. But someone might think, I've listened for so many days and it doesn't really have much meaning. The Dharma Master has been sitting up there on that platform talking and talking about the same old thing. I've heard it over and over. He says that people should get rid of greed, hatred, and stupidity and should cultivate precepts, samadhi, and wisdom. I'm tired of listening. Some of you feel tired of listening? That's darkness. However, there are those of you who don't grow weary of listening. The more you hear, the more you want to listen, even to the point that you just listen to the sound of the Dharma Master's voice and the subtle and incredible doctrines of the sutra. And when you finish listening, it's as if the Dharma Master were still speaking in your ear. From morning till night, I can hear the voice of the Dharma Master beside my ear speaking Dharma to me. That's the light. Right now, I suddenly remembered something that happened to me in Hong Kong. A certain laywoman came to see me, and after she saw me, what do you think happened? In everything she did, whether it was walking, standing, sitting or lying down, she always saw me. What do you suppose she thought? She thought, oh, that Dharma master is a demon. Otherwise, why would I see him all the time? Here she was, able to hear a Dharma master speaking Dharma at all times, and she thought he was a demon. I suppose that if she saw a demon, she would have thought it was a Buddha. So she started slandering me and even wanted to strike me. Within a month, she contracted cancer and died. Basically, I wanted to save her, but she thought I was a demon. She refused my rescue. And that's the way people are. They think the true is false, and the false is true. Guanyin Bodhisattva uses the contemplation of true emptiness to break through the delusions of views and thought. The delusions of views are defined as giving rise to greed when faced with a state. You get caught up with something that appears before you and then give rise to greed and attachment. The delusions of thought are defined as giving rise to discrimination because one is confused about principle. By means of the contemplation of true emptiness, Guanyin Bodhisattva breaks through the darkness of the delusions of views and thought. He brings forth the virtue of prajna. When Guanyin Bodhisattva cultivates the contemplation of purity, he breaks through the darkness of delusions like dust and sand and is certified to the virtue of liberation. When Guanyin Bodhisattva cultivates the contemplation of wisdom, he breaks through the darkness of the delusions of ignorance, thus attaining the virtue of the Dharma body. When one is certified to the secret treasury of the three virtues, then prajna, liberation, and the Dharma body will come about. One has to cultivate the three contemplations, the contemplation of true emptiness, the contemplation of purity, and the contemplation of wisdom, to be certified to the three virtues and to cut off the delusions of views and thought, the delusions like dust and sand, and the delusions of ignorance. That's what's meant by the sun of wisdom that breaks through all darkness. The wisdom here refers to these contemplations. The contemplations themselves are wisdom. This wisdom sun is able to quell calamities of wind and fire. Calamities here refers to the three calamities of water, fire, and wind. Water floods the first dhyana. Fire burns through the second dhyana. Wind destroys the third dhyana. At the end of the kalpa, aeon, the first of the three calamities appears. The heavens of the first dhyana are flooded by water. One doesn't know where this water comes from, whether it comes from the stars, moon, heavenly rivers, or earth, but it rises up in massive waves, and not only does it drown humankind, it also drowns the gods of the first dhyana heavens. Therefore, when the calamity of water hits, almost everything is destroyed. Somehow a few people remain, and the population starts to multiply again. Eventually, the earth gets overpopulated. People's offenses are redoubled and things get very complicated. Then, the second calamity, that of fire, hits. This Kalpic fire burns clear through the second Dhyana heavens. The gods in these heavens are burned by this fire. Why is it that fire can reach the second Dhyana? It's because the gods in these heavens still have the fire affliction, whereas the gods in the first Dhyana heavens still have the water affliction. The fire inside their intrinsic nature catches with the fire in the world, bringing about a huge conflagration. At that time, seven suns appear in the sky. The mountains, rivers, and the great earth all turn into burning coals, and people are charred to a crisp. Even the seas are all burned dry. The seas turn into dry land, and the lands become huge mountains. Then the high mountains become great seas. Many strange events occur between heaven and earth. After the disaster of fire, a very long time passes, and those people who are left in the world propagate the species until once again the world becomes overpopulated. Then the third disaster, that of wind, hits. Wind destroys the third Dhyana. Not only does the wind rip through people's houses and buildings, but the mountains, rivers, and earth are all ripped to bits. In fact, the wind reaches up to the gods of the third Dhyana heavens. Even the gods cannot avoid this disaster. So there's a verse that goes, in the sixth desire heavens, there are the five signs of decay. The third Dhyana has the disaster of wind. Even if you cultivate clear to the heaven of neither perception nor non-perception, it is not as good as going to the western land and coming back again. Before I go on, I'll explain what the five signs of decay are, because although some people have heard them, there are still others who haven't. If you've heard them, it won't hurt to review them. If you haven't, then listen closely. The five marks of decay of the gods. 1. The flower garlands that adorn their heads wilt. The flowers that adorn the heads of the gods are not like the flowers grown in the human realm. These flowers grow quite naturally right on the heads of the gods. It's a natural adornment for them. But when the five signs of decay appear, the flowers wilt. Before these signs appear, the flowers are always fresh. So when your flowers start to wilt, then you know you've just about had it. 2. Their clothes get dirty. The clothes of the gods are not like that of people. We have to wash our clothes once or twice a week because we know that if we don't wash them, they'll be dirty. The clothes of the gods never get dirty because there isn't anything to soil them in the heavens. But when the five signs of decay appear, their clothes get soiled. So when you're up there and you see that your clothes get dirty, you know that you don't have long. This is similar to when people are about to die, even before they stop breathing. Various places on their bodies will start to grow worms. Ordinarily, this wouldn't happen, but when they're just about to die and stop breathing, many parts of their bodies start to grow worms. And that's the appearance of death here in the human realm. But for the gods, the sign of death is that their clothes get dirty. This is a kind of karmic retribution. The reason we have so much dirt here on Earth is that we have too much false thinking. That's why there's such an awful lot of filth in the world. Our false thoughts are exactly the same as dirt. So the filth comes from false thoughts. 3. Their armpits perspire. The bodies of the gods are not like those of humans. They never perspire. But when the five signs of decay start to appear, their armpits sweat. 4. Their bodies smell bad. Basically, the gods' bodies always emit a fragrance, but certainly not because they use perfume or apply scented powders. Their bodies naturally exude this fragrance. But when the five signs of decay appear, they lose their fragrance and start to smell bad. 5. They cannot sit still. Basically, the gods are really comfortable. From morning to night, they just sit there in meditation, investigating Chan. They don't have anything else to do. But when the five signs of decay appear, they can no longer sit still. They sit for a while and then jump up. But once they stand up, they want to sit down again. And once they're settled down, they rise again. So they keep getting up and sitting down again. And the moment they lose consciousness, their life in the heavens ends and they fall. So the first line of the poem says, in the six desire heavens, there are the five signs of decay. But then in the first dhyana, there's the disaster of water. In the second dhyana, there's the disaster of fire. And the third dhyana has the disaster of wind. That's because the gods of the third dhyana heaven still have the wind of affliction within their nature. When a hurricane or tornado occurs in the worldly realm, it connects with the wind in their nature, and so they are destroyed by the disaster of wind. Even if you cultivate clearer to the heaven of neither perception nor non-perception, where your heavenly lifespan is 80,000 great kalpas. Nonetheless, when your heavenly reward ends, you still fall back into the human realm, or even worse, into the hells, among the hungry ghosts, or among the animals. So it's very dangerous. The last line of the verse says that it is not as good as going to the western land and coming back again. Cultivating to any of those heavens is not as good as getting reborn in the western land of ultimate bliss, becoming a boat of compassion like Guanyin Bodhisattva, and coming back to teach and transform living beings. That's a safer path to take. Fortunately, the light of the sun of Guanyin Bodhisattva's wisdom can quell all disasters and break up all darkness. As it shines, a universal light, on all worlds, the world that we common people live in now is called the land in which the common and the sagely live together. The great wisdom of Guanyin Bodhisattva also illumines the land of expedience with residue. That's where those of the two vehicles live. Expedience refers to clever, provisional means. with residue means that there's still something left because the inhabitants of this world have not yet completely cut off all afflictions. Guanyin Bodhisattva dwells in the adorned land of actual reward, which is the land where all the bodhisattvas dwell. The Buddhas dwell in the pure land of eternal stillness and light. With his great wisdom and great knowledge, Guanyin Bodhisattva universally illumines all of these lands, and so the text says his light shines on all worlds.